Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michala Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27. Today we've got a little bit of a treat for you. This is the first of a double bill of episodes of our podcast. And what we wanted to do was to actually talk about the new reports that are coming out today. That's Friday, the 6th of March. And the first of these is Karen's report, where she talks about the research that she's conducted over the last 3 years into Brexit and what it means for British citizens in Spain. So I'm joined by Karen.
Hello.
And we're trying out some new technology, which means that we're not actually in the same room, but we'll try it on for size and see how it goes. Okay, Karen, so you've written this report. It's quite a bulky report. We're looking at about, I think 14,000 words. So it's quite a lot to get through. And what you've tried to do here is to really locate the story about Brexit and what it means for British citizens who live in Spain within that longer history of the research that you've done with British citizens living in Spain. And I wondered if we could start with you explaining a little bit why you think it's so important for us to contextualise what's happening with Brexit within a longer understanding of the things that brought British migrants to Spain, the kind of factors, the structures, the histories there.
I suppose it's partly, if you've done this amount of research for this long, and I've been going to Spain since the early 1990s, you understand a lot about the people there and how they live and who they are and their lives and so on. And then when you want to understand a present situation, to hear people, whoever they may be, trying to understand the present situation through a snapshot, through turning up briefly, talking to a few people who are visible, based on misunderstandings about who they are, quick bits of information, you miss so much. This has been a long-term migration. It's taken shape over time. People have moved for particular reasons, and so many things come to be important. Just a couple of examples. One of the main reasons that the earlier migrants moved to Spain, and I am focusing on Spain's coastal areas generally. Generally, I'm not talking so much about people in Madrid and Barcelona and things like that in my own research. But people who move to those coastal areas have often moved there because they're coastal areas. That will affect how they want to live their lives, how they see their lives, how they view their lives. Another example, they've moved there when a lot of them, in a time when freedom of movement actually meant they probably wouldn't be very well regulated, that in many instances they weren't asked to register. If they were asked to register, it was kind of shrug kind of response. And in some towns they did and some towns they didn't. And, you know, you need to understand all this about who they are, that there are those working in Barcelona and Madrid, there are retired people, there are self-employed people, and that huge diversity of people. And now people with children that have grown up there who don't know anything else, who are absolutely fluent in Spanish, people who have settled. We need to understand this diversity if we're going to understand how Brexit might affect them.
I mean, I think that's been central to a lot of the work that we've done over the course of the project has been thinking about how we challenge those stereotypes, both in the way that we do the research, but also in how we communicate about the research. But the other thing that you mentioned there is this kind of, and I think you refer to it in the report as slack regulation of freedom of movement.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we know, don't we, that every country has been different. But in Spain, I can tell you that it really depends where you are and where you are based, because there's different autonomous regions. They manage things in different ways. And there will have been people who have gone to try to register and they will have been told, don't bother, don't waste my time. Not so much more recently. And that's why you do hear people condemning people now and saying, oh, I don't know why they didn't register, and all this kind of on the Facebook chats and things, people moaning about people who didn't register. But, you know, for a long time, the procedures weren't in place. I mean, I met, for example, very well-educated couple living in Granada. These are a very sincere couple, very well-educated, want to settle in Spain, fluent in Spanish. went to register locally, I'm talking in a little village near Granada, like, why are you bothering? We've got immigrants here we need to worry about. We're not worried about you. Go to the doctors, and they're using their EHIC card for years because nobody's questioning it and nobody's giving them advice to do anything differently. It's actually very often been harder to do things right than to just bump along.
I think that's really important, both in terms of highlighting the kind of local effects, but also highlighting how complex the arrangements are on a local level in terms of who has been responsible for implementing, first of all, freedom of movement and the regulations and directives relating to that, whether it's healthcare, whether it's kind of access to employment, whether it's social security aggregation. And now we have the same discussions ongoing when it comes to the kind of implementing of the withdrawal agreement, notably through the discussion of kind of people applying for residence permits and things like that. So I think it's really useful to remember that there's a longer history to these challenges at a local level.
Yeah. And I know you're going to say the same when you talk about France. And then this is the history to it. There's no good just looking at people now, today, moving out. I mean, I can go back through a time when we first went to Spain the very first time. This was before freedom of movement, actually, the first time. So I did have to go to the police station and I did have to prove I had enough to live on and I did have to show my health insurance and things like that. And then I remember going back later and trying to do all the same things again and getting this shrug, like, why are you here? We don't worry about that now. And then more recently, things have changed again. And then more recently that you can then have a right to stay for 3 months without anyone worrying too much. But then when you apply for your residence permit, then they would ask you if you did have enough to live on and so on and so on. But bear in mind then, there are people who've lived there not doing that. So when you go and you live in the same neighbourhood as all these people who haven't registered, why would you think, oh, yeah, but I'm going to have to do things differently?
It's kind of the freedom of movement directive in law versus law in practice, which might be quite a different thing, I think.
And the flexibility of the movement as well. I mean, that's a huge thing in Spain. And I think it's possibly more of a thing in Spain than many other countries, and especially like the islands as well, that you have what locally get called the snowbirds, the people who move to Spain or the Spanish islands for several months at a time. They don't even in their minds have necessarily a sense that they live in Spain. They're living in the UK and they're spending months in Spain, and people in caravans, people in motorhomes and things like that. And it hasn't been a problem. They haven't been breaking the law. They haven't been breaking any regulations. They've been doing what was expected of them at the time.
I think that's really an important point, and maybe we'll come back to it. Because, of course, the citizens' rights negotiations predominantly focus on people who can demonstrate that they are resident somewhere and that they're lawfully resident. But of course, some people's lives mean that actually residence might not be the best marker of how they live their lives, I suppose is the best way of putting that. And I do wonder what kind of challenges that presents, Brexit presents for those people, really.
It goes back to this phrase, the freedom of movement. And, you know, a lot of people have honestly taken this quite literally, meaning they were free to move. And moving doesn't mean going from one country to another and staying there. Movement means moving, you know, spending some time here and some time there. And as we know, you know, there are lots of people in our projects who will spend some time in one country and work in another. And this is the way that this has all been interpreted for British in the EU, is that they now have to choose one or other country in which to become absolutely permanent. And one thing that I do think has never been mentioned enough is this is not the same for EU citizens living in the UK, because they still remain EU citizens. They still retain the right to freedom of movement.
So what's happening in their case is that their legal status in the UK is changing, whereas British citizens are having their legal status changed precisely because they lose their right to EU citizenship and all of the related entitlements. So I just want to kind of go back to 2017. I actually can't believe that 3 years have passed since we started doing the research. And that first report that you wrote in 2017 is the one where you documented what was at the time quite extensive confusion among British citizens who were living in Spain. And
So I want to rather provocatively ask whether 3 years later, whether things are any clearer.
Well, they should be. I mean, in law, as you say, it's this difference between practice and legalities. In law, they are clearer. In law, you know, as you know, and you can probably say it better than I can because I have a job myself to keep on top of what the legalities are. But to a great extent, if someone has moved and become resident and can prove that residency, they are, and even if they continue to move now, between now and the end of this year, then they can move to another European country and they can remain and they can still have health cover and their pension secured and so on. However, there is still phenomenal confusion about, for example, if we don't get a deal by the end of the year, does this still apply? I know that the withdrawal agreement does still apply, but people don't realise that. I was just having a look myself just now before we talked, just tried to get a bit better sense myself of how the land lies now. The British and Europe group have produced 6 reports to help explain the situation now. 6 reports. Each report is several pages long. You and I, Mikola, have written reports of 14,000 words because we read and write a lot, and that's what we do for a living. Normally, in people's normal daily lives, reading pages and pages and pages of information is not normal. And to have to wade through that amount of information to try to understand your particular situation, because perhaps you've got a disabled son living in the UK and you wonder whether he might be able to come and join you, or you've got a limiting long-term illness that you know is going to get worse and you're anxious about what you might be like in 2 years' time. You've got to wade through that information and hope they've got it right and it hasn't changed by the time you finish reading it.
I think that this kind of points to a couple of things. The kind of that ongoing confusion, but also that kind of onus that I don't know if you did this deliberately, that you put on individuals having to make sense of what's happening to their rights. I think these are really important things to draw attention to, because I think the question that we've asked more recently is why is that onus so much on individuals to understand what the transformation of their rights means for them?
Yeah. Remember that wonderful conversation we had a while back when we were away at a conference and we were suddenly really angry because it was like, why do we have to, it keeps having to come back to, there's this information there, there's this information there, that nobody's actually being proactive, or very few. I don't want to deny the people the wonderful work that a lot of groups are doing and that, you know, a lot of local councillors and so on are doing fantastic work. But overall, the British government, the Spanish government in my case, the European government have not made it their concern to put the information out there to make it straightforward for people. It's what we said, didn't we, that in the end you kind of have this feeling that British people are a little bit like, well, should they have migrated? It's their fault, really. they made that choice. They are treated differently than other migrants, I think. And that has something very interesting to say about how British government feels about its immigrants. I know that's something you want to go on to explore more in the rest of your career. But it's something that has constantly puzzled me. It's not actually just that I'm blaming the governments here, but actually the individuals you speak to, they take that on board. I've written in the past about this notion of habitus, about taking on board what's expected of you and what's assumed and sort of internalising it. And I think British people have to a great extent to internalise that, so that they're doing all this work to help themselves as much as they can, being angry when people don't find out for themselves or seem to get the questions wrong or ask the wrong questions. Is the responsibility is all down to them and they have taken that on board themselves.
I mean, it is. There's two sides to that, aren't there? First of all, there's that sense that we've managed to gather through the research of a population of British citizens who live in Europe who feel that they are nobody's responsibility but their own. And then the internalisation of that, which is what I think that you're talking about, whereby they have to go out and actively seek solutions to a problem that is not of their own making. in most cases, and how in that process of trying to seek solutions, of course, there will be some fallout from
that. Absolutely,
yeah. I mean, I guess what could have been done differently, and I think that this is what this pervasive sense of uncertainty that we have documented over the past 3 years can help us to understand things, is that it's not that the information isn't available. There is information available. It's just that the additional work that needs to be done in order to communicate that clearly and in order to move that information from kind of institutional sites. So, you know, in the case of France, the French government, the Spanish government, the British government, into communities and down to the level of the individual is where the work has been lacking. And that is something that we've been arguing right from the start. And part of that comes from the fact that neither European governments or the UK government know who these people are.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The reproduction of stereotypes by the governments, by the European Union, the context of the debates, the media, journalists, politicians, is actually shocking. There's reproduction of stereotypes that go hand in hand with dismissing people. And actually, part of that, you know, even the Office for National Statistics not having reliable statistics or not being able to say why they don't have reliable statistics, because many people didn't register, because they weren't expected to or didn't know how to, you know, admit that, have an agreed estimate that the European Union and you agree on that is reasonable. Don't leave it to fact check to come up with 1.3 million that then we all use because we don't know what else to use because no one officially is coming up with one that we can rely on. Don't reduce the numbers based on some spurious miscalculations or recalculations that just leave you confused. I'm getting angry now.
What you're pointing to is you're calling on those governments to take some responsibility. You're calling on the UK government particularly to take some responsibility for its overseas citizens and to act with their interests in mind.
Mm, that's a crucial point. Act with their interests in mind. This links directly to this issue of trust and, you know, people not feeling that they can trust the UK government or the European Union or the Spanish government or whichever country they're in. And what's really interesting to me, they do feel that the British government should be trustworthy, should be speaking for them. So that's a huge lack. But one thing I find really interesting is how they have so internalized this notion that it's their responsibility, that they're individuals and they have to solve it, that they are grateful. They're grateful when they get anything, any kind of support locally or from the European Union. Well, the Spanish are doing this and the French are doing that and we need to be grateful. You know, it's really interesting that you are so lacking in expectations of your support that you're grateful. And I just also want to just go back to something else that you said that I think is really, really important, is that, one, they need the information clearly and succinctly with somebody taking responsibility for that information and how it's communicated. Two, there need to be people in place to help translate that information for particular situations on the ground and without prejudice. Because people are afraid to go and ask, because the people they're expected to ask are also the people who can say, oh, looks like you shouldn't be here, you better leave.
I think that's really, really important, Karen. Now, I don't want to turn it too much towards the individual, but I do want to ask, what are people doing? What are they doing about Brexit and about Brexit's impact on their lives in Spain among the people that you've spoken to?
There is a lot of evidence, given that there's been a massive boost in numbers of people registering. So there is a lot of evidence that people are registering more often. There is a lot of evidence that, I mean, there are some amazing support groups that the ones that I see mostly are actually on little small ones on Facebook groups and things like that, just small groups and local groups that people can go to, as well as the bigger ones that people feel that they've. So that's something that people are doing. The British are doing is that they're supporting each other. They're giving each other information where they can. Of course, this also means sometimes information is wrong and, you know, they don't get the information that they should be getting. Yeah, the consulates are putting on information for people, meetings, one of the problems there is that they will always present the government line, and they will always say things like, we still don't know for sure, and this is the best we can say, and they're the people who say you shouldn't be here if you go once you make yourself public. Local community groups, local councils are doing a lot. I also want to say actually quite a lot of people are taking on Spanish citizenship, but you're supposed to give up your British passport when you take on Spanish citizenship. The Spanish ask you to give up your British passport, but no one actually asks you. I'm hearing, and this is anecdotal, people tend to be keeping it, but then they're worried about what happens when they come to need to renew it and so on. And they have to have whole conversations about which is the best passport to use when they go across which borders and things like that. So people are exploring Spanish citizenship, which is raising some really fascinating discussions about, to me, what's the most fascinating thing of all of this is the issues it raises about who you actually are and who you fundamentally are. And I think one of the things that has come out really loudly is that these people did feel European and never really had a need to voice that or express that. And it's suddenly, oh, yeah, but I was living in Europe and I'm European. And they do feel British. And they very often don't want to give up their nationality, albeit that they are being told they need to choose to settle in another country or go home. They don't feel ready to give up their British nationality, often as well because they don't feel that they can ever truly become another nationality. Now, they say things like, you know, I can learn Spanish, I can become a Spanish citizenship, but when I walk around this village, I'm still the Brit.
I think that's really interesting in terms of those questions about identity that Brexit has brought up. And it's really evident that Brexit has been a moment where British citizens in Spain have started to question their relationship to Britain and Britain's relationship to them, as well as to question those that what they thought being British was and how that related to being European. And I think those are, you know, we've touched on those so many times, but they are fascinating questions that it's brought up, because previously, and I've said this so many times on the podcast, but previously research would suggest that British people, even British people who lived in Europe, actually had quite a low affiliation with an idea of being European. But actually, now that that's been challenged, you're getting more content to that. It's not just an empty thing that people are holding on to. It has a meaning for people.
And some actually lovely interviews with people about what that did mean to them and how being European actually meant something about being open to other cultures, being open to travel, being interested, just this a general sense of openness. And it didn't mean not being British. It didn't mean I'm not British. It meant I'm British, and so many people say I'm British and, or I'm Yorkshire and, or I'm Scottish and, or I'm, you know, but whatever identity, and European comes as a plus, but it's mainly a positive plus. Even people I spoke to who voted Leave didn't say, I don't want to feel European, I don't like Europe. They don't like the European Union and the bureaucracy. They still want to live in Europe and they still want to feel European.
I think that's really fascinating. I think for me, though, a final question is, having spent more than 25 years, I'll say, working with British people who've moved to Spain, has Brexit changed your understanding of the British in Spain? Or does it fundamentally change anything about those understandings in a way that might open up kind of new points of departure for making sense of this in the future?
Yeah, I don't think it's changed my understandings of the British in Spain. I think it's changed the British in Spain to some extent, but then the British in Spain have been changing for 25 plus years anyway. So it's very dangerous to take my book, The British on the Costa del Sol, and extrapolate from that about the British today, because they've changed. And as I said, you know, there are people who've lived there all that time and longer, and, you know, who've married into Spanish families, who've got Spanish businesses, who've got children who've grown up there. It has made me more tuned into people living not just on the coastal areas, but that's because of where my research was, and my research is for this project has to move beyond that into the rest of Spain. And I kind of knew those people existed but didn't explore them that much. I think it's more that it's made the British themselves aware of who they are and their Britishness. It's made them organise more around their Britishness and, you know, set up these various different groups. For others, it's had very little change anyway. They're just carrying on living their lives like they always were. But I think what we ought to take away from this is, you know, back to the stereotypes. I probably contributed to the stereotypes. If you take the British on the Costa del Sol as the British in Spain, full stop. The British in Spain are partly the British in the Costa del Sol way back in the 90s. They're also the British in Barcelona, the British in Madrid, the British in Granada, the young people, older people, disabled people, people of colour, people who are married, people who are single, people with families, people with disabilities. They're human beings.
I think that what you're highlighting there is the kind of limitations of reducing a population to, you know, to a particular place.
I think for me, the project has really drawn my attention to the diversity and to the richness of people's lives, the complexity of people's lives. And actually, I would even go so far as to say, I've been very impressed with some of the people I've met and the lives they're living and the work they're doing and the commitment they've got. And I've met some really, really lovely people that I hope stay friends with.
Well, that's been great, Karen. Thank you very much. And for those of you listening, Karen's report is very descriptively entitled Brexit and the British in Spain, and it will be available to download. Well, it is available to download now from our website, and I will include the link in our show notes for today. So please do consult that. But for now, all I've got to say is thank you very much, Karen.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast with me, Dr. Mikola Benson. If you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so by searching for Brexit Brits Abroad on iTunes and Libsyn. And to join in the conversation, follow us on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BrexpatsEU, and you can visit our Facebook page, Brexit Brits Abroad. To find out more about the project, visit our brand new website, that's brexitbritsabroad.org. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode.